this area. They live over in Lindenhurst, and it's a blessing to fellowship with them.
Are you turned on like that?
Yes. How's that? This morning in the Sunday school hour, and I know you were not all there, but this, I mean, all of you were not there. Probably a little both. Right. I shared the life of Adoniram Judson up through his arriving in Calcutta in 1812. And our theme verse was 1 Corinthians 15:10, because Judson was a gifted person, very, very smart. And God had to teach him through a series of steps that whatever he was by the grace of God. He had to be transformed by grace in order to be the servant that God wanted him to be. The theme passage for tonight is from 2 Corinthians chapter 12, another familiar passage, where Paul asked the Lord to remove the thorn that he has in the flesh, and we won't try to sort out what the thorn is tonight, but he asked the Lord three times that it might depart. And you know Jesus' answer to him. Christ said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee. For my strength is made perfect in weakness, in your weakness. And then Paul's testimony is, most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory. I will boast about my infirmities. Why? So that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. The second half of Judson's story is a story of suffering, weakness, and the power of Christ flowing through that weakness to impact a region of the world. And so I am delighted to tell it to you. Let me just briefly remind you that Pastor Warren and I kind of envisaged this missions conference as a follow-up to last summer's, where last summer we discussed the British Particular Revival, Andrew Fuller, that led to William Carey going forth and really launching modern missions and inspiring people all over the Western world, including in America. And college students in America said, we've got to get out on the foreign field like our British cousins are. And the result was the Congregationalists organizing for mission and the Baptists organizing for mission and a number of other American denominations organizing for mission. The greatest missionary to a foreign field from America, when I say the greatest, I'm not sure what God's critique is, but in terms of the telling of missions by humans, was Adoniram Judson, whose story we're telling this morning and tonight. And while it is an incredibly dramatic story, I appreciate the reminder that most of the time, Don and Nancy, and then Don and Sarah, and then Don and Emily, were dealing with toddlers and diapers and feeding babies and sick parishioners and walking to where they had to go. And so the drama is the reason we're still telling the story after 200 years, but the effectiveness has to do with the faithfulness. And so we want to pick up the story. I've left the slide up that was the last slide last night. Those are two very good resources on Adoniram Judson. As I mentioned this morning, I think every Christian ought to read To the Golden Shore. It is a classic missionary biography, one of the finest ever written. There are a number of other good biographies of Judson as well. The Three Mrs. Judsons is an older work on Judson's three wives, and they were remarkable missionaries in their own right, and I would recommend that. I would also recommend the memoirs of Ann Judson that have recently come back into print. They've gone through many, many editions, and they are also very valuable. So part two, sustained by grace, the rest of Judson's life. When we left Adoniram Judson this morning, he and his wife Ann had arrived in India, Calcutta, and they had just lost a baby en route. That is, Ann had miscarried. They had become Baptists, which meant that their closest friends, who were pedo-Baptists, who were Congregationalists, could not work with them and got on a ship and sailed away. They discovered that Britain had just declared war on America, and war had broken out. They discovered that the British East India Company did not allow missionaries to settle in India. It was a difficult time. And for the next 9 months, they went through what I will summarize as painful and dangerous struggles. If you read To the Golden Shore, it will be a nice 30 or 40 page discussion with lots of ins and outs and dangers. I'm not going to be able to get into all that. They were opposed by the British. War had broken out. The British found out they were in the country and tried to arrest them. They had several narrow escapes. They were basically hiding out in the villages, trying to figure out what would God have us do. You may wonder why they didn't just move up to Serampore and live with the British Baptists. They just didn't feel, Judson did not feel that he should go become a part of a compound that was already well organized, was already doing great work, and really didn't need him. He just had no peace about that. It would have been safe, but it wouldn't have been the kind of ministry he traveled halfway around the world to do. So instead, he and Anne began praying for where the Lord would have them go if they couldn't minister in India. But in the providence of God, just a month or so after he had committed to missions in spring of 1810, he had read a book about the Golden Kingdom of Burma. And he really was captivated by it. But the idea of going to Burma as a missionary, nobody really thought that way. Burma was what we would call today a closed country. They were not welcoming to Westerners. They looked down on Westerners. They did business with the British, but they thought the British were kind of inferior to them. And they called themselves the Golden Throne and the Golden Scepter and the Golden Palace, and they just believed they were superior to everyone else on the earth. They were rather arrogant. They were Buddhist. And the Buddhists are a very different religion than the Hinduism of India. Hinduism, as a pantheistic / polytheistic religion, was pretty welcoming to other philosophies of life. They figured no matter what you taught them, they could incorporate it into their beliefs. And they had a hard time with the Christian message that says, embrace Christ and reject all the gods. But the Buddhists were very exclusive. They believed they had the highest philosophy of life and that Western religion was all inferior. But when push came to shove, the Judsons had to get out of Calcutta. And they jumped on the next ship sailing out, and it was headed to Rangoon. And they found themselves in Burma in 1813. They had no support for months. That is, I told you this morning that Luther Rice, single man, also arrived in Calcutta, also converted to Baptist views, and then decided that he would sail back to America and try to rally the Baptists. He was enormously successful in doing that. It helped that almost everybody in New England and the Middle Colonies had heard about the Judsons and was thrilled they had gone as missionaries. So the Baptists were in support of the mission already. And when Luther Rice showed up and said, would you guys be willing to form a missionary society to support the Judsons, Baptists came on board in large numbers. There were about 48 Baptist societies around America, and by 1814, that is in about a year, they were able to organize a national convention at Philadelphia and vote a national organization to support missions into existence, which eventually became known as the Triennial Convention. In 1814, the very first missionaries they voted to support were Adoniram and Ann Judson. 3 years later, they voted to support John and Sarah Peck, missionaries to the Missouri Valley, Missouri and Southern Illinois. That's going to be my subject tomorrow night. So come tomorrow night and Tuesday night, and we'll tell the story of John Mason Peck. And if you're sitting there saying, I have never in my life heard of John Mason Peck, well then by all means be here. Because arguably John Mason Peck's impact on America is as great as any other single preacher in our history. A tremendously active missionary. And we'll study him tomorrow night. When they arrived in Burma, the first thing they saw was the Shwe Dagon Pagoda. And it's a magnificent structure there in Rangoon that's well visible from offshore. And they realized that they were going to face a very different prospect than the Hindus in India. The Buddhists were very much personality-driven in their politics. so that you always had to sort of be on the good side of the local politician or he could make your life miserable. They were very arrogant people because over the previous couple hundred years, the Burmese had been expanding almost continuously at the expense of their neighbors, and they were virtually undefeated. That is, whenever they pushed out, they succeeded. And they had developed kind of a national consciousness of superiority. Furthermore, when it came to the British pattern for international empire was meet people, win their confidence, give in to all their demands, move in with your traders, and take all their stuff. You know, that's kind of how they built a colonial empire. But they weren't viewed by most of these countries as powerful. They were able to sail there, but they were always small in number, and they were willing to always accept whatever you asked. The British were pretty amenable because they weren't looking for war. They were looking for colonial, they were looking for wealth. And so the Burmese looked down on the British. And for the first 6 years that they were in Burma, Judson immediately began learning the Burmese language. It was an exceedingly difficult language, exceedingly difficult. It had a written script. It had its own literature. The Burmese were a more literate culture than the Hindus he had come from. But Judson discovered that these Burmese were curious about this Western teaching, but by no means did they think he had anything to offer them that would improve their lives. They felt like their Buddhism was as good as you could get. The language was complex. It didn't have concepts like sin. You know, Buddha was essentially an atheist. Gautama Buddha, the man, was essentially an atheist who taught that there's not good or bad. There's simply pain or suffering or non-pain or suffering, and you just have to become in alignment with non-pain and desire, and you're good. And so they didn't have a concept for sin. He had to work around a lot of theological language where he had to combine various Burmese words in order to communicate concepts that were very unclear to these people. And despite all of that, he had the book of Matthew translated into Burmese in his first 4 years, which is an astonishing achievement. Now, he's going to continue revising Matthew and the rest of the New Testament all his life. But this is an incredible thing. The translation that Judson is going to complete is still used in Burma today. That is, it is an outstanding translation of the scriptures. So he was working very hard at the language. But it was slow, painful service. And after they had been in the country for a little over a year, their second child was born. They named him Roger Williams Judson. You would think they have just become Baptists, all right, when they named their son Roger Williams. And at 7 months of age, the little fella succumbed to the climate. The climate in Southeast Asia was absolutely brutal for Westerners. They didn't have climate control the way we have now. They lacked the medicines that we have. And malaria was deadly. Dysentery was deadly. And a variety of other tropical diseases that they were very prone to. Judson remained relatively healthy during these early years, despite the fact that he was adjusting to this culture as well. But after 6 years of evangelism, translation, and literally day-by-day conversation, they hadn't seen a single convert. Now, if you remember last summer, or your own reading and study, it was 7 years for William Carey before he saw his first convert. Why does it take so long? One of the reasons is that these men were determined to not simply market something to make your life better. They were determined to give a gospel of repentance that says that you have not embraced Jesus Christ until you have turned from your former philosophy of life. I mean, Francis Xavier and many other missionaries have gone to various fields and said, tack on what I'm teaching you and you get to go to heaven eventually. And people around the world are willing to tack things on. But to turn to God, turn from idols to serving the living true God is another matter altogether. And Judson was determined to not have false converts. In fact, in these early years, we read of him discussing salvation with some of these Buddhists, and the Buddhists would come that close, and it's like, Judson, just push a little bit. And instead of pushing them towards salvation, he would ask them hard questions. Are you willing to embrace Christ and all his offices? Are you willing to turn from your idols? Are you willing to reject your philosophy? And he'd chase them out of his, I mean, they'd leave and say, no, we're not willing to do all that. And Judson, well, that's what it takes to be a believer. You know, that's what it takes. But God in his grace in 1819 saved Mong Nau, a simple laborer who had sat for hours in the little zayat, the little tent that Judson had constructed by the roadside there in Rangoon to deal with anybody that would stop in. It was kind of Buddhist a tradition that philosophers would build these little zayats and sit and give free counsel to people. And Mong Nau stopped in and spent hours with Judson and came to Christ. After Mong Nau got saved, they started seeing a few other conversions, so that a small little nucleus of a church, just a handful of people, began coming to Christ. That amped up pressure from the government. That is, the Buddhist government did not want to see Burma having another religion. A handful maybe, but you start having too much success and the pressure starts to mount. And about that time, Anne's health failed. 1821, Anne became very ill, and Judson feared that she was going to die. She probably would have, humanly speaking, there on the field. And he said, "You've got to recover your health, sail back to America, greet our family there, and get better, and I'll continue to do the work here." And so they tearfully parted. She was away for 28 months. During those 28 months, she wrote constant letters to him, none of which arrived. That is, he went for 28 months with no contact from her whatsoever. And he believed that she had died. He kind of gave up on her. So what did he do? Did he quit? No. He said, "All right, if she's gone and I'm here working by myself, I am going to pour myself into the translation." And during her absence, he completed the entire New Testament in Burmese. Now, once again, he's going to continually revise this for the rest of his life, coming out with 4, 5, 6 different editions of it. But by way of contrast, William Carey's translations produced nearly 40 of them in 35 years. All were superseded by better translations within 2 generations. All of them. That is, they were great. They got the Bible out to millions of people, but they were hurried and rushed and not always really great translations. And once missionaries settled in each of the different parts of India and discovered these Carey translations, they said, "Praise God, they have a Bible. Ooh, it's not very good. This is not a real good rendering." And they replaced them one by one so that all the Carey translations were out of circulation by 1900. As I mentioned, Judson's translation is still being carried in Burma today. It is still a viable translation in Burmese. He poured his heart and soul into it. His church grew to about 24 people, almost about 20, it says. And then in 1823, after 28 months, Anne returned. It was a joyful restoration. About this time, Judson became convinced that until I get the king of Burma to issue some kind of an official policy allowing us to preach, I'm never going to be able to have much success here. So he decided to travel up to the capital of Burma. It was Ava. Ava is way up in the center of the country, not very far from Mandalay, the famous jungle city. Ava doesn't show up in many maps nowadays, but I'll show you about where it was. There's Mandalay right in the middle there, and Ava was just right near it on that river. War broke out between Burma and Britain. I can't give you a lot of backstory, but the Burmese were expanding again, and they invaded Arakan, which is a little area between India and Burma, and it was a British protectorate. And the British contacted Burma and said, "Back out of Arakan, or we're going to come beat you up." And the Burmese said, "Yeah, right. You know, you British, you're pathetic. We're not worried about you." And the British said, "All right, you've been warned." And they sent a couple of gunboats and a couple of thousand Marines. The Burmese put together an army of 100,000 men and marched down to meet them, and the British utterly routed them. It was a devastating experience for the Burmese. I mean, they ran into firepower they didn't know existed. And that's actually going to be a blessing. But at the time that the war breaks out, everyone in Ava who is Western, which included some Portuguese, it included a Frenchman, I believe, or I think it was a Frenchman, it included a couple of Brits, and Judson, even though he was American. They all get arrested. And Judson said, "You know, I'm not with those guys. You know, I'm an American. I'm not one of, it didn't matter. If you were a European, then you were put in prison. And they almost arrested her. And then, I believe by just divine interposition, they decided that she was a woman, and I guess we'll leave her free. And that was a blessing because she is going to minister to the inmates, in particular Judson, over the months. He is going to suffer absolutely horrific conditions from November, from June of 24 till November of 25. That's a long time to suffer in one of these prisons. The Burmese made the prison guards convicted murderers. That is, they'd convict them, they'd paint a black spot on them, and then they'd make them the jailers. And if they failed in their jail work, they'd carry out their sentence of execution. So these were brutal jailers. They had brutal policies in their jail. They had this bar that they ran, and they would tie the prisoners to it every night by the feet, by the ankles, and then they would haul them up to about 5 feet where they were, their head and neck were leaning against the ground. And they would leave them suspended like that, tied up for the entire night. And that's how they would sleep every night. And of course, with their head on the ground, the rats and the vermin, they couldn't protect themselves. And it's just horrific. And Judson experienced that night after night after night. Some of the inmates committed suicide. Some of them died because of the poor conditions. Judson tried to keep his spirits up, but it was a difficult thing. And constantly was bribing officials and negotiating for better conditions. So he eventually talked them into allowing him to move out of the main compound into a little building, a little bamboo shelter in the courtyard where his conditions were a little better, and he was able to survive the treatment, but it was horrible. Anne she was pregnant as he went to prison, didn't know it. She discovers that she's pregnant, so she's suffering through a pregnancy while she's doing all of this to try to care for Judson. They raid her house, and she takes all their possessions and hides them under the ground to keep them from stealing all their silver and gold. It's a horrible time. Furthermore, Judson's Burmese New Testament, he had taken it with him there to show the king, to convince him that this was good for the Burmese people. Well, they had to... The Burmese, they were afraid it was going to be destroyed. And Anne smuggled it into him in the prison, and he hid it in a pillow so that he could keep it safe there while he was in that little compound. And then later on, he's going to fear that it's lost. They're going to march him out of the compound, and he thinks he's never going to see his New Testament again. God once again preserved that Bible so that it could be copied and distributed. At the end of about a year, about 13 months, Anne was called to meet with an administrator, and he was talking with her, basically distracting her so that she would know what was happening. When she finished talking with him, she went to the compound to see Judson, and they were all gone. And they had been force marched out of the compound into the jungle, a force march to a place called Ung Pin La, a compound deep in the jungle where it was assumed that they would all be killed. I mean, why take them out of this compound unless you have some type of pretty evil intention for them? Anne found out where they were, and she followed on foot. By this time, she had just given birth to little Maria. She carried Maria with her. She became so emaciated and weak that she wasn't able to feed her baby. And she found a village near Ung Pin La where she went house to house getting other women to feed her baby so that her baby would survive. And Judson discovered that Ung Pin La was just about as bad as the other compound. In fact, in some ways, it was worse. Shortly after they arrived there, they brought a lion. Sometimes the books say tiger, but the best records say it was a lion because I'll tell you why in a moment. But they bring a lion, and they put it in a cage in the middle of the compound, and they start starving it to death. And every night, the prisoners can hear this lion just shrieking in pain and horror, and they said they're starving that lion. Well, if you're a prisoner there, you assume that they're starving it because they plan to feed it, you know. And so Judson was convinced. He told people later, he said, I was pretty convinced I was going to be lion fodder before this whole thing was done. And then one day they got up and the lion was dead. And it turns out that the lion belonged to one of the king's relatives, and the king was mad at the relative and killed the guy's lion, this pet, because in order to get back at his relative. And it worked out well because Judson asked for permission to move into the cage. And he cleaned it up, and he lived in the cage, and it was actually better living conditions than he'd been in before. So Judson is living through a very, very difficult time. And he, at one point, he's crossing over a bridge on the way to Umpin La, and he said later, "I seriously considered throwing myself off and taking my own life." He said, "I didn't, because that would have been a sin, and you never solve a problem with a sin." He said, "But I didn't want to live, because there seemed to be no hope." And the British ended the war. That is, they resoundingly defeated the Burmese. And then they requested that Judson serve as the interpreter in the negotiations. He was the Westerner who spoke the most fluent Burmese. And so they got him out of jail, and he proceeded to negotiate the terms of the Burmese surrender, and he received his final release in February of 1826. As you can imagine, Judson's and Ann's health were seriously compromised, and they had a little baby who wasn't doing so hot either. This tiny little girl who all she had known in her life so far had been hardship. Well, they went south. The British built a little town. The British occupied about half of Burma, not quite half. The lower part of Burma, they moved in their forces, they seized control of it, they built a British city called Amherst, and then they basically told the Burmese, "You behave, or we'll conquer the rest of your country. You know, we have no interest in occupying all of Burma, but we're able to whenever we want to." And the Judsons moved down into the British-occupied part of Burma, and they started a little church. That is, they contacted the believers from their former church in Rangoon, and they discovered something that was a little bit encouraging. The Burmese are not so arrogant anymore. That is, I'm not saying war is a good thing. All right, I'm not advocating for war. I'm not saying that the death of Burmese on the battlefield. I'm saying that God is able to bring good results out of a whole series of bad circumstances. And one of these good results is that the Burmese, who had been incredibly arrogant and believed that their Buddha was superior to anything the West had to offer, were all of a sudden willing to listen to Westerners. And Judson, in just a short time, in just a matter of a year or so, saw more converts than all the previous time he'd spent in Burma. His church began to grow, and it was a great blessing. And after 5 months in Amherst, Judson said, "We are doing so well, and the British are so well established here that maybe now the king will agree to open up all of Burma to Christian missions." So he bid farewell to his wife and baby, left them there in Amherst, and he sailed back to Ava as part of a delegation to meet with the king. I think if he were here this evening, he would tell you it was the worst decision he ever made, because shortly after he left, he received a letter telling him that his wife had suddenly gotten ill and passed away. She was 36 years old and had just never fully recovered from her sufferings while he was in prison. He went home, buried his wife, had to arrange for care for their little girl, and she was too frail, and just 9 months later, Maria passed away as well. And he had been in Burma now all those years, 11 years now, 12 years, 13 years, and his family is gone. He's lost them all. I believe that when I'm done tonight, we should give God great glory and say, "Wow, this Judson guy was quite a missionary." You know, I think it's appropriate for us to remember those who have led us and say, "Wow, what a hero." At this point in his life, he showed just how human he was. He sank into a pit of despair. He blamed himself for leaving Maria so that she died with him not by her side. She had been with him for 14 years. She was a wonderful and gallant missionary. He had a stillborn baby. He had lost Roger. He had lost Maria. His own health was still frail. And he did something that the historians are not sure why he did it or what his motive was or what it means. Depending on who you read, they give different interpretations to this. But he went out into the jungle, the tiger-infested jungle, and he dug a grave. And he went for a couple hours every day and would sit in front of that grave, that empty grave, and do whatever he did out there in the jungle. That is, his converts didn't understand it. They asked, "Brother Judson, it's dangerous out there. Why are you doing this?" "I have my reasons." Some biographers will say, I read one biographer that put an incredibly positive spin on this. Said he was learning how to mortify his flesh. Well, you can do that back in the compound. All right, you don't have to dig a grave in a tiger-infested jungle. I think it's more realistic to say that he kind of had this morbid sense that, why am I still alive when they're all dead? Why have I survived and they're gone? Anne was a better Christian and a better missionary than me. Why am I still here? And he sat by a grave and he thought about the fact that that should be me. Now, I say it was a few hours a day. In the meantime, he was an active missionary. In the meantime, he was pastoring his church. In the meantime, he was still gathering converts. In the meantime, he was still translating the New Testament, beginning to work on the Old. But it was a very, very hard time. I don't know how long this went on. The biographies I've read are not real clear. It appears to have gone on for weeks. But the Lord brought him through it. And if you suffer depression at times, you know, it's not the ideal condition for someone who trusts in Jesus Christ. But you have good company. You have good company. Charles Spurgeon, Adoniram Judson, others have suffered from depression. And sometimes we suffer from things that, you know, we really wish we weren't suffering from, but it's not like we're choosing it. All right? Sometimes it's this human condition. Well, the next part of his story is building the mission and a family. 1826 to 1845, I will hurry on. For 8 years, he's going to labor on alone. I don't know that he ever thought he would remarry. For the next 8 years, he worked on his Old Testament. Translating the Old Testament is enormously more difficult than translating the New Testament, especially from Hebrew into Burmese, sort of by way of his English knowledge of the two languages. So it was a tremendous struggle. He continued to evangelize. He continued to pastor a small Burmese church. And as I mentioned, the Burmese were listening now. And God began sending more missionaries to Burma. That is, other families read Anne Judson's journals. While she was home, 1821 to 1823, she had written journals. She continued those journals and told some of these stories in her own hand. And across America, the Judsons were becoming famous. And young couples started saying, we want to go and be a part of this. A lot of great missionaries went to Burma. One of the couples that went were George and Sarah Boardman. George and Sarah Boardman. The Burmese, Burma, they ruled over a large area that included a number of mountains and jungles that had tribes living in them that were more primitive. One of those tribes was the Karen tribe. And the Karen were subject to the Burmese government, but they lived kind of a wild, independent life up in the jungles. And George Boardman had a burden for the Karens. And he and his wife went deep into the jungles and the mountains and began evangelizing village to village. Dynamic missionary work, and they discovered that the Karens were very, by work of the Holy Spirit, open to the gospel. And they saw conversions and churches getting started. In 5 years, they won hundreds of Karens to Christ. But then George Boardman in 1831 succumbed to the climate and passed away as a very young man. Usually, when a husband passed away in one of these southeastern fields, the wives went home. The idea that a single woman, mission boards at this time were not sending single women to the field. In fact, that's not going to really start up for another 30 or 40 years. And their idea was, you know, what can a single woman do there? She can't plant churches. She can't pastor. She should go home and let men. Sarah Boardman had other ideas. She just stayed right there in the jungle. And she traveled around village to village in these mountain villages of these wild Karen tribes sharing the gospel. And if people got saved and a church organized, she would contact Rangoon and say, send me a preacher. And God was using her in incredible ways. Well, because she was in contact with the more established churches, she got into contact with Judson. In fact, Judson knew them. And when George died, he wrote Sarah a very sweet letter saying, listen, I've been through this. I lost my wife. I know how you feel. You ever need anything, you just call. But it was just a polite letter. 3 years later, they're still corresponding. And Sarah, who's working as a missionary in these jungles, is really impressing Judson. In 1834, a couple of important things happened. Judson finished the Old Testament. And then 3 months later, he married Sarah. And they are going to make a dynamic mission team. I showed you a picture of Anne Judson this morning in Sunday school. There is no existing portrait of Sarah Judson. But Judson himself bewailed that fact. He said, you know, my wife Sarah was a beautiful young lady, and she was an incredible translator and an incredible wife and mother. He says she was a wonderful missionary. She worked on translations into Karen, helped Judson with some of his other work. They worked both in Amherst and Rangoon, and they became sort of the father and mother of a missionary team that began gathering. She also started, they started having children together. She had a daughter by George that Adoniram adopted. And then between 1835 and 1844, Sarah bore 8 children to Adoniram Judson. Now this is while they're doing all of this missionary work. Abby Ann, 1835. Adoniram Brown, 2 years later. L. Nathan, a year later. Henry, who died at 19 months. Luther, who was stillborn. Henry Hall, a year later. And then Charles, who's going to die shortly after his mother does. That's a quick slide. Right? But there's a whole lot of life going on right there. That is, they're translating, they're evangelizing, they're working, and they're having a family. Big family. And guess what? By 1843, Sarah's health wasn't so good. That is, the climate, the demands of this large family, her health was beginning to fail. The normal way that they dealt with poor health was a sea voyage. They'd go on a sea voyage, and oftentimes the sea airs would give you enough recovery that you could go back into these climates and survive. But Judson was concerned that that wasn't going to be enough. And he decided that he was going to have to take Sarah home. Oh, I missed Edward. I'm sorry, Edward. Edward, 1844. So they decided they were going to have to head back. And in April 1845, Judson decided that for the first time since he left America in 1812, he's going to sail back and see the family and hopefully get Sarah her health back. Now, at this point, they're going to do something that I could spend 30 minutes explaining, as well as I could. I'll have to spend 2 minutes explaining it. They took their 3 oldest children, and they left the younger ones behind. So why'd they do that? Well, they were kind of caught in this very difficult missionary dilemma in the 19th century. That is, while children were being weaned, they were generally, until they were weaned, they were generally able to survive in these climates. Then once they were weaned, they were not likely to survive. They would die usually in short order. And these missionaries discovered that these children, once they're 2, 3, 4 years old, we better get them out of this climate or they're going to die. Now, once they reach puberty, 12, 13, 14, they can often return safely. But for about 10 years, it is deadly for these children. They're not sustained by their mother's milk, and they're just liable to all these diseases, and they don't have enough strength yet to fight them off. And so these missionaries are faced with these cruel dilemmas. Do we keep our children with us, probably consigning a large percentage of them to death? Or do we send them away not to see them for very often, perhaps for years? You say, well, why don't you just not have children? That wasn't really considered a live option for these people in the 19th century. For one thing, they didn't have a lot of means to do this. And for another, many of them thought that was ungodly. You say, well, why didn't they go as single people? There were tremendous temptations for single people on the mission field. Most mission boards preferred married people. That is, there's no easy solution to this. The best solution that most of them discovered was, we'll send out. But now, small children could not survive these ocean voyages very well. So they left the little ones behind, they took the older ones, and their plan was to leave the older ones in America to grow up in a safer environment and then come back in time for their little ones to be at an age where they could make a decision relative to them. That is, they're in this vicious catch-22. And so that's what they did. Little Charles, who they left behind, he was just a year old, about a year and a half old. He was 18 months old when they left. He died a month after they sailed. And so they never saw him again. Sarah never made it to America. She died during the voyage. They were right near the island of St. Helena. which is famous for where Napoleon Bonaparte is buried. And she was buried there on the island September 1st, 1845. She was just 42 years old. And that brings us to the final chapters. Judson grieved for Sarah. He grieved for his large family that no longer had a mother. And we now come to the final chapters of his life. Y'all with me? All right. He gets home October 1845. He did not expect to be a celebrity when he got home. He was going home to get his kids situated with relatives, rest a little bit. He had a throat ailment where he could barely talk. He was hoping to kind of recover his voice so that he could sail back to Burma and launch into the work again. He arrived in America and was given a hero's welcome. And churches all across America, invitations started pouring in for him to come speak to them. So he sort of reluctantly did. I mean, he had no idea to be a Mr. Hero. But those memoirs had really made them popular. And he talked about the fact that he would get up to speak and he would talk about the gospel and the grace of God and souls getting saved. And people would say, yeah, we know all that. What about the lion? You know, people wanted to hear all his exciting stories. And it really became a grief to Judson. He said, you know, I don't want to talk about myself while I'm traveling around America. I want to talk about the gospel. I want to talk about Christ. And in January 1846, he was riding on a train, and he was reading an article, and it was a little short story by somebody named Fanny Forrester. He said, man, this is really well written. I mean, it's kind of a silly little story, but it's really engaging. So he asked the guy he was traveling with, who is this Fanny Forrester person? And the guy said, oh, well, she's a believer. Very, very godly young woman. Her name's actually Emily Chubbuck. She just writes under this. And then Judson got angry. He said, what? This is a believer? And she's using her gift to write this trite stuff? She ought to be writing serious stuff. So he looked her up. He found Emily Chubbuck. And by the way, I'm not arguing that all, if you write fiction, I'm not saying you're sinning. But that was Judson's view. And Judson said, she's wasting her time. So he looked her up and said, you're a gifted writer. Would you be willing to write a biography of my wife, Sarah? Her story needs to be told. And Emily agreed to do it. And so they got together for interviews. They met quite often, and as they met together, they became good friends. And after, you know, several interviews, they became very good friends. And you know, they're talking about Sarah, you know. This has got to be okay, right? And then Judson proposed to her. And this sent shockwaves across the missionary community and across America because she was 29 and he was 57. And people were like, what? You know what? When you think you're going to be fed to a lion, and when you've been hugged up down by your toes, you do not care what anybody thinks. And if he was in love with Emily, he was going to marry Emily. And on June 2nd, 1846, the missionary statesman married Emily Chubbuck. And 1 month later, she said goodbye to the only life she had ever known in New England, and she sailed away to Burma with him. We do have a picture of Emily. There she is. They arrived in November of 1846, poured themselves into the work. There was a new city they had established a work in called Moulmein, and they poured themselves into the work there in Moulmein and Rangoon. In Rangoon, Judson purchased a large house. He wanted it to be large so that they could have gatherings there and fellowships there. It had really high ceilings and very spacious, and Emily nicknamed it the Bat Cave, because they didn't have glass windows, and every night, bats would just flock in and gather on the roof. And so she got used to living with bats in her house. And you say, that doesn't sound pleasant. Well, no. She was a really good writer, though, so she makes the Bat Cave sound good. She finished her work on Sarah by February 1847. I have never been able to get my hands on that work. I'm not sure what happened to that biography. I'd love to read it, but I don't know what happened to it. She also gave birth to a child, Emily Frances, in December of that year. This was Judson's 11th child born on the mission field. And over the next 3 years, Judson's health, which he had struggled with for a dozen years or so by now, really began to fail. But he had something he wanted to finish, a Burmese English dictionary. It was kind of a life's work. His view was, my translation of the Bible is a tremendous will have tremendous impact. But this Burmese English dictionary will enable later generations to improve on my work and to translate other works into Burmese and to really build a Burmese church. And literally, as a man who could do very little over his last year because of an ailment which had made it almost impossible for him to talk and caused him to run fevers and to lie on the couch for hours of the day, he would drag himself to his desk and work on this dictionary. And he finished it in January 1849. And he doesn't have long to go now. In the spring of 1850, about 13 months later, Emily was pregnant with their second child. And Judson, it looked like, was succumbing to a disease that might kill him. And they said, well, why don't you take a sea voyage and see if you can recover your health out at sea? And so he did. He took a sea voyage. Emily really couldn't be with him. She was pregnant and really just about to deliver. And while at sea, he passed away. And as was the custom, they buried him at sea off the coast of Burma, April 12, 1850. He was 61 years old, which I know some of you in this room think that's old. Some of us in this room think that's really young. Right? That's a lot of life in 61 years. Emily gave birth to little Charles 10 days later, but he died just hours after his birth. Emily had now lost her husband and her baby pretty much within just a few weeks. She returned to America. And her health had been compromised. She took their children, Henry Hall, Edward, and Emily Francis, back. Edward, the guy I almost forgot to mention, later wrote a biography of his dad, the first biography of his dad. I'm sorry, the second. The first biography was written by another scholar in Brown University. But that experience had ruined Emily's health, and she died just 4 years later at the age of 36. What is the legacy of his life, quickly? Well, there are tangible results. Baptist missions in Burma are going to be dynamic for the next 100 years. Francis Mason, Eugenio Kincaid, and Julius Vinton are three of the greatest missionaries you've never heard of. I mean, these guys were dynamic missionaries, their wives as well, did tremendous missionary work up and down the country of Burma. Missions thrived there throughout the 19th century. The Burmese Bible is Judson's wonderful contribution, outstanding, enduring translation. Burma, of course, is now Myanmar, Buddhist, politically oppressive, but there are an estimated 2.5 million Christians in Burma. These estimates are notoriously unreliable, but generally, when people actually get on the field, they discover they're conservative. That is, there's generally more than what people think is going on. And especially among the Karens, revival is ongoing. 15% of the Karens consider themselves to be Christians. Other than South Korea, to my knowledge, this is the largest percentage of Christians of any Asian ethnicity. That is, there's enduring results of this ministry. And the largest Christian group among the Karens are still the Baptists. But there are intangible results. And I give it to you as a paragraph. Judson's life of sacrifice, his dogged determination, his commitment to sound theology inspired hundreds and perhaps thousands of men and women to surrender to go to the mission field. And that's why today Adoniram Judson is regarded as the father of American missions. And that's why his story, while well known, should continue to be told. I know it's a late hour. I tried to talk fast. Do you have any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Did any of his children go into ministry?
I don't know. I know Edward Judson wrote a biography of his dad, which suggests he probably was in the ministry, but I don't know for sure what happened with him. It's an interesting thing that almost every time I teach on any church historical character, people want to know what happened to the kids. I want to know what happened to the kids, too. It's almost never recorded what happens to the kids. So I don't know. There were a lot of kids for something to happen to, but I don't know. Yes, ma'am.
I don't understand. What is it about the climate that would kill Europeans if it killed Burmese?
Yeah, it's your body has to be accustomed to the particular germs in the particular area where you live. And, I mean, there are people in Africa who live with malaria, and it doesn't threaten their lives. A Westerner can get malaria, and it, without the medicines, can be dead in a very short time. And there are a number of these diseases that were just rampant in these climates. In Africa, in Central Africa, it became the white man's graveyard, where missionaries just poured into Central Africa and just died by the hundreds. They discovered that the higher they could go topographically, the safer it was. But it took them a long time to discover that, because that's where the dangerous people were. So they would generally settle on the coast, and they would die, and then more would come, and they'd settle on the coast, and they would die. And it's a very sad story. Medicines and climate control have changed the story. But the 19th century is a story of tremendous sacrifice, where people would go to these fields knowing that the life expectancy is less than 2 years. You probably need a medical answer. I can't give you that. I'm a doctor, but not the kind who helps people. Yeah. All right, thank you so much for your attention. John Mason Peck tomorrow night is worth learning about. I hope you'll come. And not only for that, but to hear these missionary presentations. Looking forward to those. Pastor?